So thanks a lot for the introduction. I guess I have nothing to add for this title slide, so I will dive right in. So here's kind of my outline on what I'll be talking about today. So first, I'm going to introduce what fuzzy dark matter even is. So I'm sure not everyone is probably all too familiar with it. It's kind of not the most mainstream thing, I guess. And also the motivation and theoretical background, like why are people interested in it and what are the equations that we are looking at and so on. And then I go on to, what the special features, I guess, or the unique features of fuzzy dark matter are with respect to cosmic structure formation. Then I'll go on to the numerical methods. So what my work basically is, how I'm solving the relevant equations on a computer and why this is actually pretty expensive and difficult. Then I'll follow up with the work I've been doing basically for the past few years and kind of the results I have so far on the simulations I've done, and I've looked at several observables such as the matter power spectrum, halo mass function, halo profiles, and so on. Also, I'll show a bit, not my own results, but kind of a more broad overview maybe of the constraints on this dark matter model, and then summarize at the end. Okay, so what is this fuzzy dark matter? I have here kind of the mass range of potential dark matter candidates, which is pretty huge actually. And fuzzy dark matter is right here towards the left of the very lightest things you could maybe think of when you think of particle dark matter. Unfortunately, there is kind of for a while, each person like writing a paper about this decided to make up a new name, I guess, for this kind of dark matter model. There's like fuzzy cold dark matter, Bose-Einstein condensate set dark matter, ultralight or extremely light boson dark matter, wave dark matter, axion-like, and so on. But mostly these are pretty much all the same thing, more or less. And what it actually is the idea that dark matter is composed of an extremely light scalar particle, where extremely light means a mass of around 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. Just contrasting to one of the lightest particles we actually know, the electron with its kilo electron volt mass. That's a huge difference of many orders of magnitude, obviously. And because of this, we need a non-thermal production mechanism. Otherwise, this would be just, with light dark matter, this tends to be warm or hot. So this kind of goes without saying, I guess. And then the important part about bosons, which these scalar particles are, is that they can form a Bose-Einstein condensate. So they kind of act collectively. And because of this tiny mass that I mentioned, if you think about quantum mechanics, the de Broglie wavelength, it scales as one over the mass, so inversely. So you actually get macroscopic wave effects. And in this case, for this specific mass value on kiloparsec scales, so on the scale of galaxies. And this is also why it's called wave dark matter. You're not actually thinking about individual particles in this case, really. And this has the consequence that structures resist collapse below this de Broglie wavelength. And you can think about this in terms of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, or people also call this a quantum pressure kind of thing. But on large scales, this still behaves equivalently to cold dark matter. Now, okay, for the motivation, why are people thinking about this? I guess there's always the particle physics and astrophysics side. From the particle physics side, well, originally, you had the axion already in the 70s as a solution to the strong CP problem. I guess it was called that because the axion washes away the strong CP problem. So I don't know if they actually named it after this laundry detergent here, but whatever. So fuzzy dark matter is not exactly this QCD axion. The QCD axion is a little heavier on the mass range, but axion-like particles, as they are called, are a common feature of string theory, and people call this like the X-diverse or something. And from the astrophysics perspective, as you may know, in the Lambda CDM model, you have these small scale tensions or challenges or whatever you want to call them, like the cusp core problem, the missing satellites, too big to fail, and things like that. And people thought, okay, well, since this kind of dark matter model actually modifies the small scale behavior, maybe this helps with these kind of tensions that we have. Right. And yeah, I guess you can see the scale again. This kind of mass value is chosen because if you make this even lighter, then the large scale structure is actually also affected because the quantum wavelength gets so big. And if you make this heavier, then it becomes very much like a cold dark matter. I guess also kind of a motivating reason is, well, we've been looking for WIMP cold dark matter and we haven't been finding it. So maybe we should explore all the avenues that there are. Okay, so the equations, or what are we actually doing with this fuzzy dark matter? Right, so really it's really just scale of field dark matter with a specific like very light mass value. So if you have general relativity here, you just add a scalar field phi, and this kinetic term, you have the mass term, and you could also have self interactions. And I'm already going to say now that I'm not considering these self interactions. So fuzzy dark matter is a special case of a superfluid dark matter. Yeah, I guess in the no self interaction or zero temperature limit. And for this is also still kind of a pretty generic thing to do. So for the QCD axion, for example, a potential like this could arise from the periodic potential that you have. And now if you rewrite this relativistic field phi and kind of factor out the very fast oscillations in time, then you can take the non-relativistic limit and the kind of Newtonian gauge in the FRW metric. And if you do this, then you end up with something that looks like the Schrödinger equation, actually. Well, you have the Hubble term here, but otherwise, it's the same. And it's coupled here to this capital phi, which is the Newtonian potential. Right. So what is this field psi, actually? So this is, of course, not the normal one particle quantum mechanics equation, but you have to think of this in terms of the mean field approximation. So this is a single macroscopic wave function of a bosonic condensate. The density, the mass density, is given by m times the absolute value squared. Right, and now taken together with the equation for the Newtonian potential for this phi, which is the Poisson equation, you have these non-relativistic fuzzy dark matter equations, and these are the ones that I'm actually having to solve in my simulations. They have kind of an interesting feature. They're defined by a single scale, or if you rewrite this kind of which is given by h bar over m, which is also related to the de Broglie wavelength. Again, it's the same factor that appears there. And this Poisson equation might look funny, but again, this absolute value squared is just the matter density. Yeah. Okay, so now just a really broad overview of what you can expect, what fuzzy dark matter actually does. So the first thing, I'm concerned with in my simulations are my initial conditions, and my simulations start around, as these structural formation simulations do, around redshift, 100 or something. So I have to input some kind of a primordial matter power spectrum, and compared to cold dark matter, which is the blue line here, fuzzy dark matter, depending on the mass value you choose, it has kind of a cutoff at small scales. And for lighter masses, this cutoff moves to larger scales, and then it's just suppressed here. And there's some code, axion camp, for example. I think there's maybe also other ones which you can use to compute this power spectrum using Boltzmann equations, basically. And this obviously suppresses the seeds of structure below this quantum wavelength, as I mentioned. Right, and then if you go further, the dynamics of these equations and the structure you get are also, well, very different from what you have in cold dark matter. In cold dark matter here, as you can see in this kind of picture, everything basically down to the smallest scales collapses into small subhalos. So it's basically clumpy all the way down. If you use a suppressed power spectrum like this, and which is similar to warm dark matter, then you have these smooth kind of density distributions. Below a certain scale, you don't get these halos anymore. And then for fuzzy dark matter, this looks very similar, but because of the wave effects, you have these kind of interference patterns going on, because you can have constructive and destructive interference, just as you would for quantum mechanics or just for any kind of wave. Right, here's another example where I'm just contrasting on the left a small fuzzy dark matter is simulated volume, and on the right a cold dark matter one. Yeah, and it's again kind of the same picture. You can see on the large scales these kind of filaments and largest halos, you can see them in both images, but everything in between basically is kind of smoothed out, and you can again see these kind of fringes here, these interference fringes. And in the cold dark matter case, you just have little clumps everywhere basically. All right, now I'm showing a video again, just this is all just for illustration, so you can kind of have an image in your mind on what this looks like. This is again a simulation, and I'm just zooming in on a particular kind of area, and this is a slice through the simulation box. Yeah, and this is kind of showing how, how these kind of interference patterns move around, and that you also have this kind of granular structure in kind of halos. And yeah, this is of course very different from what you would see in cold dark matter or anything that doesn't have this wave behavior. But yeah, this obviously looks very different. Right, but this is not the only effect that you get. You actually form new kinds of objects in this dark matter model. So the first one that's quite important is the so-called soliton. So this is the ground state of these fuzzy dark matter equations. And at the center of dark matter halos, you will form these. And they're pretty much a spherical flat density object. So these are kind of, dark matter cores basically at the centers of halos. And this is of course very relevant for the cusp core problem in cold dark matter, and which is why people were interested in this kind of thing. Right. And another thing that's relevant with these things is that actually, it's similar to the things I showed in the video, for example. You have transient fluctuations around this core. As you can see, it's all very granular here. And this can, for example, disrupt star clusters or lead to dynamical heating. Here's another video, I guess, where these kind of objects, it's kind of basically a toy setup. You place a bunch of solitons and then let them merge. And I'm just showing this so you can see what these kind of granular or kind of transient fluctuations are and what they look like. I think this is a pretty long one, so I'm probably gonna not let it finish. But yeah. Right. And another kind of object that you actually form in fuzzy dark matter is vortices. So I will show in a minute fuzzy dark matter fluid velocity is actually a gradient flow. But there's an exception. So in the destructive interference regions, the density can become zero. And again, I'm going to elaborate a little more, but there the velocity is actually undefined. So there you can form, these regions are basically where you can, around which you, if you kind of integrate the circulation around these kind of points, you can get vortex rings. And this happens in pure fuzzy dark matter, but also with self-interactions when you have a rotation, just a rotational kind of fluid, then since this is a superfluid, you actually also form vortices there in addition. And this can be quite interesting. We don't actually know very much about these objects, But yeah, these are, of course, again, things that you don't get in cold dark matter. Right, so now I continue to the numerical or computational side. I've introduced these Schrödinger Poisson equations before, which are basically the basic fuzzy dark matter equations. Another approach actually that you can do is if you take the wave function, I'm just gonna call it the wave function. I mean, it's basically, square root of the density. people are sometimes arguing if this is, because it's not really quantum mechanical, it's like a, macroscopic wave, but anyway, if you split up this wave function into the absolute value and the phase, then the density is basically given by the absolute value squared. And well, the phase, well, if you kind of split up your complex equation into two real ones, the phase is, or the gradient of the phase is actually related to something that looks like a velocity. And then you basically get these hydrodynamics equations, or they look like hydrodynamics equations. First one is just the continuity equation, and the second one looks like the Euler equation, but you get this additional term Q here, which is this so-called quantum pressure, that's where this, or quantum potential, that's where this term comes from. You still have the Poisson equation. But again, the problem with this kind of splitting up the wave function in phase and absolute value is that the phase is actually undefined for zero density or wave function zero. And this can have, well, you're kind of missing something if you use this formulation. People have looked at this briefly. Here, for example, on the left is the picture where it's, you have the full wave dynamics, and on the right you use this kind of fluid dynamics approach. And okay, so you can see this a bit better. This hydrodynamics kind of set of equations, you lose all these interference effects and so on, because it just can't represent this. And that's also why I decided to stick with the Schrödinger Poisson equation, even though the fluid dynamics ones are a bit easier to handle maybe. And the method I used to solve these equations is a pseudo-spectral method. So here are the equations again. And okay, I see someone raised their hand.
Hi, Simon. I just wanted to ask real quick. So is it the case that you make some approximation mathematically when you write down the fluid equations, or is it that numerically there's some difference in the way you simulate things?
Right. So this is actually a thing from quantum mechanics. This was like Madelung, this person did this in the 1920s, actually. So as far as I know, there's no approximation mathematically, but I guess, you're not taking into account this case of rho equals zero. So, I guess it's kind of, you're neglecting a singularity basically in your equations, more or less. Or you introducing one that wasn't there before. So I think strictly there's no approximation, but kind of, because of this special case, that's why you get the differences also in the numerics as well.
I see.
Oh, and there's another question.
Well, just to follow up on that, Do you then apply some softening in the Madelung approximation when you have rho equals zero to avoid that numerically?
Right. I've never actually done these kinds of simulations, so I'm not sure. I don't think so. The problem is you don't really. Well, okay, you notice it here, I guess, in this term. But I don't know if you can maybe rewrite this in terms of where you don't get this problem. I'm not aware that there's any special like approach. I think people just basically use SPH to solve these like normal hydrodynamics. But again, I've not used this before, so maybe they do something more involved.
I think the rho can never go to zero if you solve these equations. Can it? Because in co-moving, if you if you just evolve the density of particles, then I mean, the density never goes to zero.
Right, I guess. Yeah, if you start, you know, if you start out from this, then I guess you don't get a problem. But yeah, the problem is then you're not solving the same thing that you would if you would have these equations.
So Sinew actually has done these sort of simulations, right? So can you?
Yeah. So the problem is, in fluid simulations, you don't expect this rho go to exactly zero, but that's the case where you have this Poisson Schrodinger equation. And then just a more technical stuff about this term is that you see the square root of rho, I mean, just dimensionally on both sides, it cancels out. It doesn't really depend on the value of the rho, but how they distribute. You can write this down as the second order derivative of the logarithmic. And then because of this logarithmic, so if you, when your rho should be exactly zero and you don't set it zero to be put on floor, it will induce the order one error here. It's not a truncation error, which you can be reduced with the increased resolution. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I guess, yeah. Showing this here from your paper, actually. Okay, yeah, I guess I'll go on. So as I said, I'm focusing on these equations myself. I'm using a spectral method. This is similar to n-body methods. Well, I mean, the time integration is similar to n-body methods with this kick, drift, kick kind of approach. So what you can do is if you take the wave function, you know, you don't have to look at this in all detail. Basically, just if you kind of look at the solution for the wave function at some future time, then you can make for small time steps delta t, you can approximate and use the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula and choose second order accuracy. Then you get these three terms. Where you have basically the exponential with the potential here and the exponential with the derivative in separate, well, just separated out. And yeah, the nice part about this is, well, the potential acts on the wave function only in real space, and the derivative, if you think about the Fourier transform, it only acts in K space. And yeah, that's the idea that you can, well, solve one thing in Fourier space and the other part in real space. And of course, if we want to do numerics, we have to discretize our field psi. So that's what I do. I take a Cartesian mesh with a fixed resolution in three dimensions, and then I apply this algorithm on it. So yeah, for the kick, this is really simple. You just apply this phase factor, this exponential to the wave function. Then you transform to Fourier space with the fast Fourier transform, where this Laplacian just becomes k squared. Then you transform back. Of course, you have to update your potential as well. And this is actually in PM particle mesh codes, they also use kind of the same thing with the Fourier transforms. And then you have to apply this potential kick again. So of course, I said small time step. So what is the time step actually? What does it have to be? So you can look at both of these exponentials here, these complex exponentials, and what you should avoid obviously is that this phase factor here is larger than 2 pi, because then basically you wrap around to zero again and you get aliasing and things like that. So this should not happen. So yeah, for the spatial part here, basically you get something that's proportional to your spatial resolution, which I call delta x squared. And for the potential, you just, if your potential becomes bigger, then you may have to make your time step smaller. And this delta x squared is actually quite a problem. Because as you make your resolution better, actually your time steps have to become quadratically smaller, and then things become quadratically more expensive. That's the question again.
Yeah, hey Simon. I just had one quick question. So like, so in these spectral methods, so you have some Nyquist frequency, right? So then you have to worry about like aliasing, you know, modes that are above Nyquist into the modes that you're actually capturing in your box, right? Because you have some, you know, nonlinear like Poisson equation, right? And so, you know, do you have to worry then about, you know, modes with K bigger than K Nyquist, you know, then getting wrapped back into, you know, modes that are at K less than K Nyquist, you know, artificially?
I guess you do, but, fortunately, I don't know. Okay. Well, you're saying they get it wrong. I'm trying to think how.
Well, so you're squaring psi to get the density, and then the potential is, you know, Poisson equation on density, right? You know, and so in principle, if I have some, let's say, K max in the wave function, then I'll have, I guess, like 2 K max in the density, right?
That sounds, yeah, like it could be a problem. To be honest, I haven't thought about this part in too much detail because, again, this is actually what people use in the, in the normal particle mesh code. So I kind of, just use the same thing. I'm not sure. You take the absolute value square, though. Maybe that has something.
Yeah, but you still have 2 K max, I would think, then appearing in psi squared, right?
Right. Yeah. At this point, I can't really give you an answer that is a problem. But I guess this should be not too difficult to find because, again, this is a pretty standard thing that people use. But that's a good point.
It might just be worth, though, you know, just like doing some simple check, right? You know, where you maybe, you know, try some simulation where the de Broglie, where the highest wave number is, you know, is like less than half of the Nyquist frequency. And then just make sure that this gives like the same answer, you know, if you change the Nyquist frequency.
I might have to look into that. I never really thought about this. That's a good point.
Okay, great. Thanks.
All right. Okay. Right. So anyway, the nice part about this spectral method, it's more or less, it's spatially, it's the most accurate you can get, I guess, well, depending on your resolution. I would say this is the most direct or reliable way you can solve this kind of thing. You don't get problems like if you use finite differencing thing or so on, that you maybe have to worry about conservation of mass and so on. Yeah, as I mentioned, you can adapt the existing particle mesh code, which maybe causes you to not think about the details of that one in too much detail. And the implementation is actually not so difficult. But yeah, the kind of two big problems are, first of all, as I mentioned, this quadratic dependence on the resolution, the time steps dependence. But at the same time, you just don't use such high resolution, right? But you actually do need to use very high resolution for these simulations. And the reason is the following. So as we saw in the Madelung formulation, the fluid velocity is related to the gradient of the wave function's phase. This is this part here. But if you discretize or you have a discretized grid, then the gradient, there's a limit to, you know, how much of a gradient you can have, because the phase is, you know, is also periodic. So at most, if you assume it's phase different between two cells of 2π, well, that's the maximum value of the gradient basically you can have between two points or two adjacent points, right? So this gives you actually a maximum velocity that you can represent on your grid. Right. And yeah, well, this corresponds to the normal particle velocity in maybe n-body simulations. And yeah, so correspondingly, if you need to resolve large velocities, then you have to have a good resolution delta x. And of course, this also has to do with the particle mass that you choose. Right. And now, what is the effect of this kind of criterion or requirement on the resolution? So here I have a bunch of small test boxes, 1 megaparsec again, of different resolutions. And I'm also showing the, well, it's here the this maximum velocity that you can represent. And here on the bottom right, there's the equivalent Kohlberg meta simulation, and the kind of 99th percentile velocity here is 100 kilometers per second. So, well, yeah, I guess you can guess, use this as a measure, which what the kind of the maximum velocities are that you need to resolve. Actually, all these ones, except, well, the last one here, don't resolve, well, these 100 kilometers per second. And I guess, well, if you compare directly the high resolution one with the lower ones, for example, I don't know if you see this, but here on the top right, there's a small dot that appears that you don't have here in the other ones. And then in the really bad resolutions where you can see the individual pixels already like 48 cubed or something, you can see that this kind of structure here on the bottom left, for example, it puffs up and it, yeah, it's not as compact anymore. But you know, this you could just see from the comparison. I mean, if you looked at this at the top right, for example, how would you know that something went wrong? It's kind of problematic. And yeah, here's a similar example by someone else, where yeah, if you have a lower resolution, well, if you have maybe, for example, merging halos, if you can't resolve the velocity that's required to, well, for them to actually, you know, meet the, they might, in a low resolution run, they may be separate, and in high resolution, all of a sudden, they may merge into a big one. So you halt or delay the evolution with this without necessarily, you know, immediately knowing about this. You can also look at the power spectra, the meta power spectra, to see if you, well, at least if you converged. So here are the kind of same resolutions again for the fuzzy dark matter simulations in different colors. And you can see, well, that, and this is a problem, you know, that you don't have an n-body method, simulations. So even on the large scales here for the bad resolutions, actually you don't, like, your evolution stops or is delayed actually when you don't have enough resolution. So I guess on the small scales, you maybe expect this. These are also the, well, okay, here in this box, everything is nonlinear at redshift zero, but on the small scales, they're the nonlinear ones. So I guess you can expect if you have not enough resolution that you, you know, kind of get a resolution effect zero. But even on the large scales, if you don't have enough resolution, yeah, you get wrong results basically. And this 512 cubed, I mean, even here, it's not entirely converged yet. And this is a pretty, you know, high resolution already. So, right, this actually becomes very expensive. And this is kind of a more quantitative way to look at this. So the computational costs just given by this time step criterion scales with inversely with the mass and due to this resolution squared here, inversely with the box size squared, if you have fixed grid size or with, well, if your grid size is n cubed, then n to the fifth power. So yeah, if you make your grid bigger, your Cartesian mesh, then it just becomes extremely expensive really quickly. And yeah, in this plot here in different colors, I'm showing different value of the particle mass. And now basically if you fix your grid size and well, you want to think about, okay, how big can I make my cosmological volume? Then I'm plotting here the computational cost as a function of this, of this volume basically for these different masses, as I said. But then there's also the problem, again, you can't make your volume too big because then, you know, your resolution obviously gets worse in this direction to the right here because the grid is fixed. So you kind of want to go that way because your simulation gets cheaper with worse resolution, but then these shaded areas show you, okay, that's when you start violating the velocity criterion. And yeah, even, you know, well, first of all, you can see that you're very limited here. Like you have a hard time even reaching something like 10 megaparsec. And secondly, even if you like take the worst resolution that you can basically, so right at the edge of the shaded area, it's more or less flat. And yeah, 10 million CPU hours, that's not cheap. So, right, this is very problematic. And yeah, just to summarize, why is it difficult to simulate this fuzzy dark matter? Yeah, you have a very large dynamic range because you need to resolve both the de Broglie wavelength and large structure that you want to have. And yeah, as I said, the velocity criterion, even in low density regions, this is shown here on the right, here on the bottom is the density and on the top is the phase. Even in these regions where it looks like there's nothing, you can have, you know, flows going on, inflows, outflows. So yeah, even there you have rapid oscillations. And yeah, this delta X squared time step criterion, basically this is a tag team to make things difficult. Nevertheless, I tried to go as far as I could with this spectral method, just to also to have a baseline for these kinds of simulations. So my kind of vision for this was, you know, you have, well, the initial conditions, the initial suppressed power spectrum as one part, and then the nonlinear dynamics as the other part. And these are the main ones that set fuzzy dark matter apart from cold dark matter. And so I wanted to kind of do a four-way comparison of cold dark matter with and without the suppressed power spectrum and fuzzy dark matter as well. And yeah, here you can see, well, on the left, the unsuppressed, on the right, the suppressed initial conditions. And these are, yeah, the large fuzzy dark matter simulations that I did, which are the largest, well, wave simulations anyway that have been done so far. Right, I have, I guess, also some parts where I zoom in a bit more, just so you can see again, well, what this looks like. You can have this, this is some kind of thing merging here. These all slices again through the simulation volume. And things you wouldn't get in cold dark matter, like these waves radiating out here, and obviously all the interference patterns you see everywhere. Right. So just again for scale, like the grid size was 8,640 cubes, so 645 billion resolution elements. Just storing this takes 10 terabytes of memory, and right, this again took a lot of time to run. And I, even then, we only managed to reach 10 megaparsec over each volume. So yeah, as an outlook here, I mean, we know on large scales, fuzzy dark matter behaves the same as cold dark matter, or I will also show this here. I mean, this is something that I showed also with these simulations again. And yeah, maybe, or hopefully this is possible to address using hybrid methods, because basically on large scales, we know what's supposed to happen. So how can we avoid this cost basically of these super expensive simulations? Yeah, and I'm showing the results for the matter power spectrum here. So these are several redshifts. So the top panel is always just the power spectrum, and on the bottom it's as a ratio to the cold dark matter one. And the blue lines are the cold dark matter or a cold dark matter simulation. The orange one, fuzzy dark matter one, and then there's also like this gray for the linear theory. If you evolve this through this redshift just linearly. Right, and at this early redshift of 15, you can see, well, the blue line cold dark matter in the unsuppressed case, already you have hierarchical growth setting in on the smallest scales. And for the fuzzy dark matter case, even in the unsuppressed case, it's, well, even below the linear theory line still. But on the other hand, as you can see here, everywhere on the largest scales, this all agrees. So this is basically a numerical confirmation of this also again. Now at redshift 7 already, this looks quite different. And these lines, like the cold dark matter and fuzzy dark matter, the blue and orange, are actually quite close in both cases, in the suppressed and unsuppressed case. And this is a similar for redshift 5 here. And well, yeah, I went up to redshift 3, and there actually, in these two, you can see an interesting effect. So I guess I'll focus on this redshift 3 part here again. So even though obviously fuzzy dark matter on smaller scales is suppressed compared to cold dark matter, on a specific scale, you can get this bump here where the fuzzy dark matter power can actually exceed the cold dark matter one. And yeah, this is often attributed to interference patterns. I'm not sure if anyone has like quantitatively looked at this before. I still want to do that at some point. Also, because that kind of intriguing, I guess, is that for the suppressed case, this is at a different scale. So this is kind of strange. Yeah, I'm going to look at this maybe still. But yeah, I guess one thing you can see here from this is that kind of the effect of going to the suppressed power spectrum, so from the solid to the dashed line, and the effect of going from cold dark matter dynamics to fuzzy dark matter. I mean, it varies, of course, you know, depending on what redshift you're at. At the early redshift, yeah, you're, of course, the suppressed initial suppression is still very, very strong. But actually, at around, yeah, redshift three or like later times like that, the effects seem quite similar. So one question I had, and which I still want to kind of answer, is maybe how, in what sense, or how much can we get away by just, you know, using a suppressed power spectrum and maybe not having to use the very expensive fuzzy light matter dynamics. Right, looking at the time here, yeah. I guess I can, yeah, this just shows the resolution requirements again. I guess this is not, I've talked to about this like in some detail, so I can go on. So, right, another thing I wanted to look at now, since actually, I mean, people before were doing like 1 megaparsec boxes, so you're not going to have a lot of halos. So in my box, well, it's not huge, but at least you have, some kind of statistics now. And I wanted to look at the halo mass function now also in full wave simulation, which hadn't been done before. And well, I found that actually, you know, how do I identify the halos in my simulation? It seemed like, or it seems like doing this on a Cartesian grid that didn't really exist. So I had to write my own kind of parallel halo finder to do this. And yeah, I did get a measurement for the halo mass function. So again, here the HMF on top and just the ratio to cold dark matter at the bottom. Blue line is from a cold dark matter simulation. This orange and green is from the unsuppressed fuzzy dark matter case, and the red line is from the fuzzy dark matter with suppressed initial conditions. And this kind of dotted line here is what people have found using, just using the n-body with the suppressed power spectrum. So this red line actually looks very similar here, also in the full simulation. I'm not done analyzing this yet. And also I'm kind of ignore this red dotted part here. This is kind of a technical problem I'm having with identifying the halos in this case, because they are kind of all connected smoothly with filaments. And this is, the halo finder doesn't like this. So I have to kind of find a good way to filter these out. Right. So yeah, but in this case, actually, yeah, for the halo mass function, it seems like the initial suppression makes a much bigger difference than the, just the nonlinear fuzzy dark matter dynamics. Right. I also looked at the halo profiles. So there's fuzzy dark matter on the left and cold dark matter on the right. And this is for different mass bins of halos. So each line is like basically stacked or average of a lot of halos in a single bin. And in cold dark matter, I get the normal NFW as always. And for fuzzy dark matter, I get, as people have also found before, in the center, this flat core, the soliton, where there's also some kind of fitting formula, and this fits very nicely. And in the outer parts, you have the NFW kind of tail. And right, since I had a lot of halos in my simulation, then we actually used this to think about a question, which is the core halo mass relation. So basically, if you have a halo of a given mass, then what will the mass of the core be that forms at the center of this halo? And actually, yeah, in the literature, people like, there were several papers out, and each one had a different relation, so a different slope for what this relation would be. So for example, this black dashed line is one of them, and then there's this orange line that's a different one. And basically everyone disagreed on this. And what we saw then in my and also well, my collaborators' simulation actually was that, well, the halos we get, they don't actually tightly follow any of these lines. They, like, there is a huge scatter between, well, basically this whole shaded area here. And unfortunately, we can't go to such high masses here. But still, I mean, this is very different from what other people have seen with a much smaller number of halos. So yeah, I guess this solves maybe the problem of why people were getting different results, because depending on your merger history and so on, you can get very different core masses.
So just to better understand this, like, so is this black line like the under the 1/3 scaling that Scheib et al. Got, and then like, yes. So you're finding something steeper than M to the 1/3? With some scatter?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. So we discussed about this a lot, actually, and I guess in my opinion, I don't think we can, like, it can't be argued that there's a single line that goes through mm-hmm. these green and purple points. So, I mean, I guess you can't really say we're finding something steeper. I guess what we're saying is, you know, there's not really a relation to begin with, at least not one with a single exponent. Like, you have variation quite a lot. I mean, I guess you can plot you through the middle, which would be steeper than 1/3 if you want to do that. Right.
It seems that you're getting generally like larger core masses than would have been predicted by that Scheib et al. Relation. Is that a fair
point? Right. Well, again, yeah, if you take like some kind of average or something, I guess you could say that, yeah. But I don't know how useful that statement is.
Yeah. Neil, go ahead. I can't.
I was just going to say, I mean, like, well, people want to use these cores, these big cores, to constrain like the properties of fuzzy dark matter. And so if you're finding in your cosmological boxes that these cores are more massive than the naive scaling predicted, wouldn't that then suggest that therefore we can get stronger constraints on the particle mass?
Yeah, so of course the idea was to look into how this affects the, you know, if you want to model dwarf galaxies and so on, the cores. I don't know if the constraints are necessarily stronger. I mean, because of the scatter, I would say they're, well, actually a lot weaker, because you can't, you know, you have to include this uncertainty in your whatever constraint you're making. And well, then, you know, since you can't make, you know, since you're adding to your error bars, I guess the constraints will become weaker, I guess.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, I have a question. For Scheib's result, it seems like they can find quite massive halos above like 10 to the 11. But why in your results is this shaded green dots, right? It's kind of unlimited.
The purple ones. Well, I guess mine are the purple ones.
The purple ones. But they still seems to be smaller than the...
Yes, so that's kind of the consequence of me using the spectral method, because I couldn't go to redshift zero with this because of the resolution requirements. So
just the redshift is there.
Okay. Yeah, what Shiva, I mean, he went to redshift zero, and well, I don't remember exactly what he did, but I mean, he has this AMR code, so I guess. These dots are also not all separate halos. These are like one halo in different stages of its evolution. So it's kind of, well, he has one that's more massive, but yeah.
Oh, I see.
Kind of
I see.
A different thing. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, as I said, we were looking at this because of the question of if these cores can explain the dwarf galaxy density profiles. And the problem with this is, unfortunately, that the more massive the core gets, fuzzy dark matter core, actually the radius becomes smaller, it becomes more compact. So this is kind of this line here. And if you compare to observations. Well, I don't know how reliable these are. I understand these are actually somewhat controversial always. But if you look at the core radius in dwarf galaxies compared to the halo mass, or just in galaxies, I guess. So this takes the opposite direction. Actually, this radius increases with increasing halo mass. So it seems like fuzzy dark matter doesn't really answer this question. I mean, in my opinion, it doesn't have to, but I guess people were excited about this. So that's a bit unfortunate. Go on with just for completeness, as I mentioned, I mean, my code that I used, I wanted to go to large scale. So I didn't really focus on these really small scale things like stellar clusters, stellar streams, and so on. But things you can look at, for example, if you have a soliton in your dwarf galaxy and there's a star cluster, like in Eridanus 2, there's, for example, this cluster. And these move around with respect to each other, then you can actually tidally disrupt the star cluster. And then you can use this to think about, okay, depending on my fuzzy dark matter mass or on my core size and so on, if I see like a globular cluster like this, then you know what would the mass have to be so that this actually survived so on. And also, if you think about gravitational lensing, dynamically eating of stars, like all these fluctuating and transient granules and interference effects, of course, can have a huge impact on all these kind of small scale things. And this is really exciting on the one hand, but also, since it's so expensive, quite difficult to investigate. Right, here's, to finish off, kind of an overview of constraints that have been made on this fuzzy dark matter mass. And I guess you can argue about many of these. This is more of an overview of what you can do. So, large-scale structure, I mentioned, gives you kind of the lower bound that's pretty robust. But then you can also look at Lyman alpha forest or a 21 centimeter line to see what happens there. And these constraints are, they're not really from full simulations. These are basically taking the suppressed power spectrum. So one thing I want to do, for example, with the Lyman alpha forest is to look at if you see anything, anything new, if you actually include the full dynamics, and maybe you can get better constraints that way. Star clusters I mentioned, dynamic friction and stellar heating are also things. This dwarf spheroidal thing on the bottom here is if you want to explain dwarf galaxy cores with fuzzy dark matter solitons, which I guess you don't have to do, but it makes it maybe a bit less motivated to look at this model. Right, so I think that's mostly it from my part. I'm just going to summarize here what the main features of the fuzzy dark matter dynamics are. So first of all, the primordial power spectrum, where small scales are suppressed, where there's a cutoff. Then also just in the nonlinear dynamics, you have the same thing, obviously. You have this de Broglie wavelength below which you suppress structure. The formation of new objects like solitons and vortices. And of course, these wave interference effects or granular kind of structures that are also fluctuate in time. And this leads to a very rich astrophysical phenomenology, as I try to maybe hint at in this talk. And the problems for numerics. So why can't we, do a big simulation and figure this all out? The time integration behavior, where it scales with the resolution squared, and at the same time, at least in my method, you actually need good resolution, but this applies to all methods. Basically, you need to resolve like the de Broglie scale, otherwise you don't get really sensible results. And this is because of the rapid oscillations in this, even in low density regions. Of course, you need a very large dynamic range, again, because you need to resolve both the large and the de Broglie scales. And I guess for me personally, I mean, I have a lot of things saved up. I actually need to get out and publish because I was actually on maternity leave recently. And yeah, I mentioned before the Lyman Alpha Forest. I'm working on simulations with this actually too. So this, so far, almost everything was dark matter only. So yeah, including variance is definitely an important thing that needs to be done, right? By my count, there's like 2 simulations published, which like meaningfully include variance with fuzzy dark matter with these wave simulations. So yeah, that's definitely a very, big open area there. Right, and I'm, kind of in that same vein, I think it makes sense to look at, well, maybe even galaxy formation with fuzzy dark matter. So in my case, I of course would need to use adaptive resolution now. I can't rely on the pure spectral method anymore, even though it's, has its advantages. And yeah, I think in the future, or if there's to be made progress on this, there needs to be some good hybrid scheme where you can factor out the large scales where we, as I said, we basically know what happens. Right, and because of this, these nice astrophysical, this phenomenology, you have like so many small scale signatures you could look at with variance. I mentioned all these things, stellar streams, dwarf galaxies, actually with vortices, like recently there, there was the observations that, that filaments can actually rotate. So maybe, if you have vortices, basically a kind of quantized angular momentum, maybe this rotation is caused by these vortices in fuzzy dark matter. That would be very interesting to look at. Okay, yeah, that's basically it from my side.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Simon. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk. Okay, so any further questions for Simon?
I have a question about the Lyman Alpha Forest, let's say, because in a larger scale, highest resolution simulation is defined as a increase of the power spectrum, right? Is back to the CDN and attribute to the filaments, right? No, not the filaments, just the interference. I'm wondering if that's the case, could that be some kind of signal in the Lyman Alpha Forest which we can probe somehow?
Right, yeah, I suppose it could be. I guess I would have to look at the scales, but yeah, this is exactly the kind of thing I was talking about when I said, well, of course you can get some estimate here on the bound on the mass if you just take, like in warm dark matter, the suppressed power spectrum. But yeah, I think it's also worth it to look at if these unique fuzzy dark matter behavior, if this, for example, yeah, as you mentioned, the shape of the power spectrum, if this influences the Lyman Alpha Forest in any way. And yeah, this is kind of why I want to look at this. So yeah, definitely.
Yes, thanks for the talk. Yeah, I'm happy to chat more with you if you'd like to.
Yeah, sure.
yeah, afterwards. Feel
free to contact me or anything.
Yeah, so I was curious actually about this slide here. So you said that if you want to account for baryons, then you can't use your current spectral method. So can you just further elaborate on that?
Right. I mean, for things like the Lyman Alpha Forest, it's fine. But this is specifically, talking about, the things like galaxy formation and things like that. So if you want to resolve all these small scale things or, what goes on with the baryons, I think, it doesn't really make sense to stay at a fixed resolution, which is the main problem of the spectral method. And that's why I think, of course you can run a super expensive huge simulation with very good resolution, but that just seems wasteful. So I think, to look at anything to do with, what happens in galaxies, I think, adaptive resolution is basically a prerequisite, I would say.
Oh, so your concern is that like small scale structure in the baryons might then generate like a smaller de Broglie wavelength in the fuzzy dark matter? Is that the concern?
Just in general, so to actually meaningfully resolve the what the baryons are doing. I mean, if your dark matter kind of field is so, you know, has such a low resolution that is basically constant across the whole, you know, galaxy, I guess you don't, you're not really seeing the effects. Like you kind of more or less as I heard, like a constant potential or something in your whole galaxy from the dark matter. I mean, I guess you could do it, but I think you wouldn't see the interesting parts of fuzzy dark matter.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, like maybe I'm just perhaps I'm just misunderstanding. I mean, like so in your simulations, you are resolving the de Broglie wavelength everywhere, right?
Right. I mean, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, we'll assume you are, right? And so then, well then, if you then also then add galaxy formation, is the concern then that the very dense, like baryonic structures, might shrink the de Broglie wavelength somewhere?
I guess one thing is, I showed the halo mass function here. So if I actually do full fuzzy dark matter, then I don't actually have that many halos, and they're pretty small if I stay at redshift 3, for example. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me there's not much or not that much point doing, you know, galaxy formation if your biggest biggest galaxy is like a dwarf galaxy or something. I mean, you can, of course, do that. But then, you know, if you focus on like a zoom-in thing, you know, if you want to do something like that, then obviously, yeah, then especially you want to look at smaller structures. And then, again, I don't think you can get away with just a fixed resolution. Mm. I mean, I'm sure you can do something, but it doesn't seem so worthwhile to me. It's more of a general thing, like not any specific effect I'm worried about, just the things you can look at, you know, using a fixed resolution, I think are limited with respect to galaxies.
Sure, sure. Okay, thanks. Any final questions for the speaker? Okay, so if not, let's stop here, Craig. So thanks again, Simon, for your great talk. And thanks everyone else for coming.